This is Law in the Time of COVID-19. I'm Adam Goldenberg. If an employee who works from home trips and falls in their own kitchen, is that a workplace-related injury? If I have an employee who has moved out of the city, can I require them to come back to the office? And what can I do if they don't? On this episode, I'll speak with some of the hardest working folks in law business, labor and employment lawyers, about what employers need to know about work from home, return to office, and everything in between. Law in the Time of COVID-19 explores the law and policy of pandemic response and recovery. We're looking at how governments, organizations, and individuals are managing the impact and meeting the moment. And because it wouldn't be a law firm podcast without a disclaimer, here's a disclaimer. McCarthy Tatro is providing this podcast as a public service, if we may say so ourselves. It may contain legal information, but it does not contain legal advice or a legal opinion, recommendation, or statement of policy of McCarthy Tatro. Here's our episode, WFH 101. There was at least a brief moment, more than 2 years ago, when working from home was something new, and at least a little bit exciting. Now, at the start of year 3 of the COVID-19 pandemic, some of us have come to enjoy the flexibility, privacy, and efficiency that remote work can offer. Others of us, meanwhile, never want to spend a workday in such close proximity to our pajamas ever again. Within any white-collar workforce, you'll find employees in both of these camps, and in the middle, you'll find their employer. To help us understand the practical challenges and potential pitfalls of managing remote and hybrid work arrangements at the same time over the long term, and some of the issues that can arise when an employer asks an employee to return to the office, I spoke to three of McCarthy Tatro's labor and employment experts from across the country. Justine Lindner is a partner in our labor and employment group in Toronto. Laura DeVries is an associate in our labor and employment group in Vancouver, and Émilie Thibault is an associate in our labor and employment group in Montreal. We spoke on Tuesday, April 12th. Laura, Émilie, Justine, thank you all for joining us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us.
Émilie, let me start with you. There's a case out of Quebec. I won't say too much about it, but it got some headlines at the end of last year. Can you tell us about this interesting workers' compensation case?
Absolutely, Adam. So the case you're referring to involves the employer Air Canada, and it is a decision that was issued by the Administrative Labor Tribunal in the end of last year. It discusses a case of a customer service agent falling down her stairs at home during her lunch break. It was notably put forward by the employer to challenge this injury that when the fall occurred, the employee had already unplugged from her workstation and left her work area and was then heading downstairs to make herself lunch. And as such, the employer argued that the required nexus between the activity and the work was not met because the fall did not occur in the course of her work, but rather while the worker was engaged in a personal non-work related activity. And I was not surprised, frankly. The tribunal sided with the worker and instructed that an employee working from home ought to benefit from the same protections as an employee who works within the employer's premise. This decision, of course, Adam, generated a lot of emotion, feelings amongst employers because they have limited ability to monitor or oversee their employees' home and whether it's safe or not. But from my perspective, this decision is not really pivotal, at least in Quebec, because the state of the law has been very consistent in the last years to the effect that so long as there is a connection between the activity performed at the time of the accident occurred and the performance of the work, well, the claim is then admissible. And I think here, the time between her falling downstairs and leaving her workplace was just very short.
Okay, well, let me take up one comment that you made, which is that this was an unsurprising decision. Yes. Is that because this has been the law in Quebec for a long time, or are there other factors that made this outcome not surprising to you as a practitioner?
Well, I think the the aspect that was not really surprising for me is the response from the tribunal when it said that I don't really care if the employer doesn't have control over the premises. It can still be construed as a work accident, because I've dealt with cases in the past where it involves a Christmas party. And of course, we can think that the employer does not really have control over the hotel where a claim can occur. So it was not really news to me. It's just, it's different because now it's an employee working from home. But because it's also an accident, which differs from an occupational injury, then a different legal framework applies. So that's why I was not very surprised.
Okay. Well, I can tell you that it was surprising to me as someone who doesn't practice in this area. And I assume it was surprising to others, which is why it got the news coverage that it did. But let's find out if it was surprising to our colleagues in other jurisdictions. So let's start in my home province of British Columbia. Laura, is this a sort of determination that you've been seeing in your own practice and that you expect to see going forward?
Well, I'm certainly not surprised to hear of the decision, generally speaking. I mean, in British Columbia, employers have the obligation generally to ensure the health and safety of all workers working for them. And there's nothing in the legislation that says that that doesn't apply if they're doing their work someplace other than the offices or other premises of the employer. So from a general legal perspective, the tribunal ultimately came to the conclusion on the facts, and these decisions are always fact-specific, context-specific, that in this case, she was doing work or it was sufficiently connected to her work to constitute an occupational injury. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the same result in British Columbia.
And taking you up on the point you made about these being fact-specific determinations, if I'm an employer and I've got employees working from home and I want to reduce or mitigate the likelihood or the possibility that I could end up in the situation that this employer did in Quebec, where an employee injures themselves walking down the stairs on their lunch break or some such thing, are there things I can do in order to reduce, mitigate, or otherwise deal with the risk of ending up in a situation like this?
Well, WorkSafe BC is, does have guidance out for employers and directions really to ensure working with the employees to make sure that their work environments are safe. You know, frankly, as a practical matter, someone could trip and fall in the office as well. And it might feel a bit silly that that's an occupational injury if they happen to trip and fall, but it's, that can happen anywhere. And so employers, do have the obligation to make sure that employees' work environments are safe. That becomes more difficult as a practical matter when their work environment is in their home. But you can put policies in place requiring employees to make sure that their home work environments are safe, ergonomic, et cetera. What you can do as a practical matter to follow through on that is sort of up to the employer how far they want to go in that respect. I haven't seen clients, demanding to go into people's homes and ensure that they've actually complied with those guidelines, right? It's an interesting situation, but provided you're following all of the guidance, you've got policies requiring employees to make sure that their work environments are safe. You actually sort of maybe walk them through the process. Okay, let's check if there are any printer cords that you can trip over. But at the end of the day, people can trip and fall, and that is just kind of how it is.
Right. Although, I mean, it seems to me, as someone who has a workplace that I go to and someone who has a home from which I work, that it's one thing for my employer to ensure that there aren't things for me to trip over when I'm in the office, that my employer is responsible for, that they maintain, that they oversee, that they lease, as compared to my home, where I don't know that I want my employer coming into my house to making sure there aren't loose boards on my stairs or other tripping hazards that I might injure myself on while I'm working from home. So let me take this to you, Justine. Is there guidance that employers ought to be mindful of when it comes to the level of, for lack of a better word, intrusiveness that they ought to employ in ensuring that their employees, while working in spaces that they as employers don't control, aren't subjecting themselves to harms for which the employer might end up liable or responsible in the event that there's a work-related injury?
I mean, the short answer is there's very little that most employers are prepared to do to be intrusive. I do know of some employers who have asked employees to send a picture of their workstation, mainly to do more with privacy considerations, to be honest, than health and safety, because some employers don't want to ensure that their workers are, you know, working in a space where no one can see their screen,
right,
for example. What I've seen clients do and what we've advised clients on has more to do with providing workers with access to valuable resources that will help them set up a safe and ergonomic workspace from home. And I think that's probably the place that a lot of clients and employer organizations can go to try to mitigate these types of risks. Generally, the types of injuries that we're seeing tend to be these, you know, a trip and fall or back pain, neck pain, things that may be associated with sitting in a sedentary position for a long period of time. So query whether your work setup at home or, you know, do your employees have the resources to have a good setup at home if they're going to be expected to be in front of a computer for a long period of time.
But in terms of risk mitigation or risk management on the part of an employer, is it going to be enough to say to a tribunal or some sort of decision maker, look, we gave this employee a handbook that says you ought to get an ergonomic workstation set up. We provided them or made available funding for them to acquire equipment to have an ergonomic workstation. If the employee still turns around and says, well, I didn't do those things, but now I've got a sore neck and a sore back from doing the job that you're paying me to do, are the employer's efforts to make resources available enough if the employee doesn't take advantage of them?
So the purpose behind workplace insurance, and my colleagues can jump in on this, but workers' compensation schemes, is that it's kind of a no-fault situation. So if the worker gets injured in the course of performing their employment, this is where they go.
Yeah.
Okay. So in at least the workers' comp world, we're not as concerned about like a due diligence type defense that we would be concerned about if there was, for example, a complaint or a charge or an order made under health and safety legislation, which is kind of its own, kind of another separate bucket.
Right.
And there, you know, that's where we would turn to these items and try to see and put forward an argument on behalf of an employer to say that they did take steps reasonable in the circumstances to protect the health and safety of their workers. Because the workers working from home, these were the measures that were reasonable in the circumstances. Maybe even providing workers with these types of resources, like, you know, an ergonomic setup or resources to do that, funding to do that, may even be well above and beyond what would be expected. But in terms of a workers' compensation injury, the analysis isn't so much what did the employer do. The analysis that tribunal is doing is just, was the worker injured in the course of their employment? And in Ontario, it's a very similar analysis to Quebec and BC, where they're looking at, you know, where did it happen? Was the employee reasonably expected to be where they were injured when they were performing the work? When did it happen? Was it during the worker's like fixed hours of work? Did they have flexible hours? So did it happen at a time that makes sense that they would be working at that time? And were they actually engaged in the performance of work at the time when they were injured? So those are the types of analysis, very similar across the provinces, it appears.
Yeah, it sounds to me, and I'll go back to you first, Emily, that this is generally speaking the same broad framework that's going to apply in Quebec as in Ontario when these sorts of issues arise, the same factors that would be considered. Is that fair to say?
I would think that the nexus required between the work and the injury is a little, I would say the interpretation is more liberal in Quebec. So I would think that claims are generally more admissible than they would be in Ontario.
Fair enough. And how about British Columbia, Laura? No difference?
I think it's broadly similar.
Yeah. So if we're taking the considerations that apply in determining whether or not a injury that someone sustains while working from home is going to be considered a workplace-related injury is generally consistent across the jurisdictions that we're talking about here, maybe a little bit more liberal in favor of the employee in Quebec, as Emily just pointed out. Can an employer just avoid and overall reduce the potential liability for workplace-related injuries by just saying, all right, everybody come back to the office? We don't want to be worried about how you may or may not be maintaining your home, where the cords may be, things you might trip over. Isn't the simpler solution to just say, everybody back in the office and we'll mitigate our risk that way? Is that potentially a reason to push in favor of a stronger return to office policy? Let me start with you on this one, Laura.
Yeah, I mean, potentially, to the extent that you've got greater control over the office environment or the other workplace environment than you do over the home environment, you know, the assumption there is that it would be safer. I'm not sure that it totally holds true. At the office, you've got interactions with other people. It could be a more complex environment. There could still be hazards in at the office that could lead to occupational injury, right, just as there are at home. So, you know, maybe if the control aspect really appeals to you, but I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a huge rash of these work from home injuries that we're seeing. And so it would be interesting to conduct a comparison of prevalence of injuries in, say, an office environment at a traditional office versus a work from home office. And I don't know that there are statistics on that yet, but I'd want to see that data before I told employers that they were going to reduce their occupational health and safety risk vis-a-vis, you know, office worker type employees just by returning them to that traditional office.
Let's move away from injuries specifically and just talk about the decisions that employers make about working from home versus not working from home. My understanding is that, generally speaking, there are policies that different employers have put in place about bringing people back to the office or back to the workplace. And then there are individual level discussions that happen with employees who may say, I'm not comfortable being back at work. I've got a particular sensitivity, or I'm immunocompromised, or I've got asthma or some such thing that makes me uncomfortable being in a workplace while there's still a respiratory illness that's highly contagious and going around. And how are employers dealing with those sorts of requests as they try to both have policies that are of general applicability and that nonetheless respond to the needs and desires of individual employees? Let me start with you on this one, Justine.
Sure. So I think that if we've seen a real variety in the approach that employers are taking right now, whether that's sort of a mandatory return, a hybrid return, whether they're doing it on a voluntary basis. And I think primarily when they're communicating that policy, it needs to come along with a little statement somewhere that says, you know, we will accommodate as required by applicable law, you know, and have a means for employees to reach out, a contact person, for them to reach out to an HR to share that information. So, and where we tend to get phone calls is when HR or an employer has received a request that is a bit odd, or, you know, and they're questioning whether this is something that actually rises the level of something that needs to be accommodated, whether it's a medical accommodation or a family status accommodation. We've seen all sorts of things, especially this is more going harkening back to discussion around vaccination policies, but religious exemptions. So it really is, you know, equipping the people who have to make those decisions in your organization with the tools they need to assess those requests, reinforcing that any request that comes in is going to be determined on an individual case-by-case basis. The result that, you know, ultimately what's decided, let's say that there is a decision to give someone some flexibility because they live with someone who is immunocompromised and they've provided adequate supporting documentation. And in the situation, that is sufficient for the employer to decide to give them an accommodation in those circumstances. You know, it's emphasizing that it's not necessarily a permanent fix. So This is something that we're putting in place for you on a temporary basis. We'll be following up in a reasonable period of time. And so I think that when we're helping organizations create these policies, put in place these policies and plans, those are the kinds of things that we're thinking about. And then on the flip side, we're seeing the result when questions come in about whether this is something that needs to be accommodated or not.
I mean, just the way you're speaking, it sounds to me like this is the sort of thing that people should be documenting, their reasons for granting particular accommodations to individuals, their communications with those individual employees about the accommodations and the reasons that they're being granted. And I assume so that like cases can be treated alike across an entire workforce. Is that, or am I describing roughly speaking, best practices, or what are the best practices if I'm misdescribing them?
I think you're describing the best practices really well, because you want to always emphasize you're going to decide these cases on an individual basis, but you also want to be internally consistent in your organization so that there's no allegation of discrimination or favoritism in the way that you're applying your policies. So it's key that, again, you've got someone who's dedicated, whether it's a person or a team who's dedicated to doing this, who will share information to make sure that it's being applied consistently.
Laura, one thing that Justine just said is that there should always be a caveat that's communicated that individual cases will be accommodated or accommodations will be granted in accordance with applicable law. The corollary of that, I presume, is that if your a desired accommodation is not something that applicable law requires, then you don't get an accommodation necessarily, or you shouldn't count on one. How are employers dealing with adjudicating the sorts of requests that they're receiving and separating genuine or bona fide requests for accommodations based on medical conditions like I've got asthma or I live with someone who's immunocompromised, and requests for accommodations that perhaps don't seem quite as bona fide or might be a little bit more dubious? How are employers supposed to make those determinations in a way that doesn't expose them to litigation risk?
Well, the first step is always to sort of ask the employee for a little bit more information. So employers are entitled. So let's assume as a starting point that we're getting a request on some sort of medical basis, whether it's for the employee themselves or for someone they live with that, you know, they can't work at the office or the workplace for whatever reason that's health related and COVID related. The first step would be to, ask the employee what is it about your condition or your circumstances that make it not possible? Because sometimes you'll just get a statement, oh, I've got, breathing issues, and so I can't be exposed to COVID. Well, that's not necessarily, that's not an explanation really. And the employer is entitled to know what it is about the employee's circumstances that makes it not possible for them to perform their normal job duties or perform them the way that they usually would. The next step typically is to seek medical documentation from the employee's medical team or practitioner, whoever that might be. So we would often draft a letter to the employee, enclosing a letter to their medical practitioner asking for further information. Now, you're not entitled to details of the employee's medical condition necessarily, but you are entitled to know, again, in the same vein, what is it about their condition that makes it not possible for it, do they have a condition that makes it not possible for them to, or not medically advisable or unsafe for them to return to the office? How long do you expect this to persist? Are there measures that can be taken to mitigate the risk or to accommodate the employee to make it possible for them to work in that environment? For example, if we provided them with a closed office that they don't normally have, or if we ensure that there's X layers of plexiglass and everybody around them wears a mask, or, I'm just hypothesizing here, but
sure.
So you can ask for details like that. And then you can propose reasonable accommodations. And that is intended to be a back and forth process between the employee and the employer. And maybe the accommodation is to grant the work from home request for a period of time with reassessment as the circumstances of the pandemic change, or maybe it's something different, or maybe the employer is able to say this is actually undue hardship for us to grant the accommodation, and you've rejected the other accommodations, and so we're going to have to take some other course of action. So it is very much a case-by-case analysis, as Justine said, but the employer is entitled to certain information directly connecting the employee's circumstances to the request that they've made.
Just for listeners who might not be familiar with the concept of undue hardship, could you just explain what that is and how it relates to dealing with requests for accommodation?
Yeah, so if an employee, so the human rights legislation in Canada, broadly speaking, requires employees in each jurisdiction not to be discriminated against, and that includes a policy that adversely affects them or a practice that adversely affects them because of a protected characteristic. And here we'd likely be talking about the protected characteristic of physical disability. And so an employer is obliged to accommodate an employee's physical disability, should one be substantiated, to reasonably accommodate the employee's physical disability without incurring undue hardship. And undue hardship is basically excess hardship. Is it just such a burden on the employer's operations or such a financial burden that it's really just not realistic? It's not reasonable. It's too much to ask of the employer in terms of accommodation. That's sort of, I would say, an explanation of undue hardship.
Yeah, Justine, Emily, anything to add to that? Well, let me make it more specific. Justine, if an employer is asking themselves, will making this accommodation involve undue hardship? Does the accommodation include sort of the menu of potential accommodations include, as Laura just said, putting the employee in a closed office and also allowing them to continue working from home? These are all potentially reasonable accommodations that an employer has to consider, subject to the proviso that they don't have to endure undue hardship in order to accommodate the employee.
Yes, all of those sound reasonable in most circumstances, right? When we talk about undue hardship, it's a very high threshold to hit in a lot of circumstances. We're usually looking for things, and often there isn't a lot of sympathy for financial hardship, at least in our tribunal system. So we're often looking to see whether undue hardship, you know, whether it trips some health and safety issue, you know, and when I say that, I mean, theoretically, like, it's unlikely to come up in this type of situation, especially, okay. And here's the challenge, especially if someone has been working from home for a significant period of time throughout the pandemic, to say that you cannot accommodate them in a work from home environment will be extremely hard to be successful at the tribunal. And that's really what, you know, a lot of employers are facing now, is it's very hard to offer an alternative to work from home or to really insist on bringing people back, because let's face it, we've all been doing it for a significant period of time and it clearly worked.
I'm assuming that we really just miss seeing your smiling face around the office is not considered undue hardship.
No.
Okay, fair enough. Emily, let me ask you about what happens when things get a bit ugly in these sorts of exchanges. An employee doesn't take no for an answer on this, and the employer genuinely does not believe that their asserted reason for needing to continue working from home is a genuine one. How far and how hard can an employer comfortably push this issue before they get into a really messy situation where potentially external counsel get involved?
I'm going to talk from my perspective in Quebec.
Totally.
If you push an employer and say, this is, for instance, I don't see here a protected ground involved in this request, so I'm going to refuse respectfully your accommodation request because rightfully I don't have to get involved in this process, then ultimately we get to a formal request to the employee to return back to the office, for instance. And usually what we're going to see is the employee will oftentimes not answer to their requests, no longer show up to work. And we're going to likely conclude that either it's a voluntary termination, the employee left their employment, then the employee will likely file a claim for constructive dismissal. And that's where it gets really complicated in Quebec, because especially for employees with more than 2 years of service, they have this remedy for complaint for dismissal without cause, and it's they get assistance free of charge from a lawyer, and then you start exchanging very soon thereafter letters with opposing counsels.
I see. Okay, let me.
It escalates quickly.
Okay, well, on that, this is something that I think as external counsel we will have things to say about. But on the issue of constructive dismissal.
Sure.
Is there a risk in Quebec that if I have an employee who has been working from home for the last 2 years because of COVID-19, and I say to them, look, you now need to be back in the office, and they don't have a protected ground or some legally powerful reason to continue working remotely. They just prefer to continue working remotely because it's more convenient. They have childcare responsibilities, whatever it is. And I say to them, well, I'm sorry, you either have to be back in the office or you can't continue to work here. does that amount to a constructive dismissal under Quebec law, or could it?
Well,
I should
say. It depends, right? And just, I think we need to take a step back before answering this question. I think the first element that we have to assess is to how was it communicated in the first place when the employee started working remotely?
I see. Okay.
Did you tell your employees it was permanent, it was temporary, it was because of COVID-19, or did you tell them it's for foreseeable future, this is going to become your new workplace, right? If this became a working condition that you told your employees, you know what, you can move away from the city, you can move 3 hours from the office, I don't plan having you back in the office for years, and then you ask this employee without reasonable notice to come back and return to the workplace, I don't have a crystal ball, but I can reasonably see that this can definitely amount to constructive dismissal claims.
I see. Okay. So it's going to a lot of going back in time and looking at what was communicated in early 2020 when people were sent home from the office. How were they told, and why were they told they were being sent home? Is that what we're looking at here?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think also employers are also navigating in this. It's still a gray zone. We don't really know if employees are going to work from home, hybrid arrangement. So I think also for most of our clients, what I'm advising them, at least for now, especially for new hires, is when they communicate with their new hires, is tell them that as of right now, it's temporary, it's a work from home arrangement, but likely the situation will be that you will be requested to work from the office at a certain point so that it does not become a situation of changing the working conditions if you ask them to return to the office.
And Justine, is the law, generally speaking, similar or in line with what Emily's just described in Ontario?
Yes. So the basics around that are absolutely the same. The challenge is the challenges I'm seeing are not so much from employees who were in office, then went home during COVID-19, and were sort of, their expectations were kind of managed a bit appropriately, like, hey, we're coming back. Eventually, the challenge is people who were hired during COVID-19.
Right.
What was put in that contract? Okay. Did they understand it to be a work from home role? Is there a place of employment put in their employment contract? Is there an expectation, or, you know, was it communicated at the time? Because that's where I'm seeing a little bit more in terms of complaints and movement and pushback on coming in and saying, hey, I joined this organization, I understood this to be a work from home position, or I told you when I was hired that I expected to always be able to work from home a certain amount of time. And now, you know, essentially there was a bit of a, whether it wasn't put in the contract in a very clear way or wasn't communicated in a clear way, now we have some challenges. It is so key what Emily was saying about how have expectations been managed throughout? And how is it communicated, and how much notice are you giving people before coming back? Because I think that that's also where we've seen a real uptick in accommodation requests, because employees know that they were always expected to come back, but if they have to turn on a dime and come back in 2 weeks later, then they're going to have family status requests. They're going to be concerned because suddenly they have to make entirely new childcare arrangements, or they are truly concerned about the impact on their health and they need to explore that a little bit further. So we're generally recommending as a best practice, like, give notice where you can, manage expectations, retain discretion as to where employees will be working and what kind of arrangements they're going to have.
I just want to make sure, pausing here before I move on, that I didn't misstate things earlier. When I was asking a question to Emily before, I suggested that needing to stay home in order to provide childcare would not amount to a protected ground or a kind of legally cognizable justification for requiring an accommodation. Am I right about that? Or is that, because you mentioned family status just then, Justine, is that something that an employer could be required to accommodate?
If I might just add a specific comment for Quebec, I think it might differ then from the rest of Canada, but family status is not a protected ground in Quebec.
Interesting. Okay. And when you say family status, is that what you're describing, Justine? Like, I can't just come back to work because I'm homeschooling my kid or some such
thing? It has to be triggered by a legal obligation to provide care. So,
I see. Okay.
You know, so whether it's childcare or sometimes elder care we see as well. But what we're sometimes seeing is, here's a classic. I can no longer commute into work and still be able to pick up my child at 4:30 p.m. when the daycare closes, and I am the only one who is able to pick up my child at this time. Someone, I have a legal obligation to care for my child as of 4:30 p.m. And, you know, accommodation is a process, right? So
I see.
Okay. You will expect the employee to explore alternatives and, you know, over time and come to find solution, but you may have to set in place a temporary accommodation or consider that again, they can't turn on a dime and change that arrangement.
Right. So it's not just a matter of saying my child must attend this one daycare because it's the one they attend. I'm not willing to consider putting them in another daycare that's more convenient for work where I can pick them up at a different time. I'm not prepared to consider different daycare hours. If the employee digs in their heels like that, that's not participating in the process of accommodation as you've described it.
I mean, that's arguable, but okay. Yeah, it's family status is pretty messy. I'll be blunt. The case law is kind of all over the place on this, and it tends to be pretty favorable towards employees,
right,
and their ability to make choices for their families. But the short answer is, like, there is an obligation for them to engage in process. That may mean, hey, have you explored, is there anyone else in your child's life who can also pick them up at that time? You need to explore alternatives, you know, and yeah, another daycare is another alternative for them to explore. Emphasizing, like, that's why I always emphasize, make sure that you've made it clear to the person that this is a temporary accommodation, that you expect them, you're working with them to come up with a solution that will work for everybody. But you're, you know, as an employer, you're being reasonable and saying, I know it's not perfect, but hey, can you come into the office until 3? Because that would get you there on time.
I see. Right? Okay.
So you can think, you know, think through alternatives. It doesn't necessarily mean they get to work from home.
Right.
Permanently, but think through the alternatives. Think about what will work for your business and also accommodate the need. But we are seeing a lot of that, including with elder care as well, because you can understand a lot of people just don't have the same support system that they may have had pre-COVID.
So, I mean, it's, first of all, listening to this conversation, it sounds like you aren't just legal advisors, you're kind of also communications advisors, all of you, helping employers communicate effectively and clearly with their employees. So I my respect for your area of practice is growing by leaps and bounds as I hear you describe the sorts of troubleshooting that you do. But well, Laura,
but Adam, like, that's what's so key is all of those communications, when ultimately there's litigation, we're turning back to the employer and saying, where are all those communications?
Right.
Well, we need them to be able to defend, to use to defend the claim.
Well, that I'm familiar with from litigation. Like, where is this written down? That's not the new, but it's the real time advising that is such a daily part of your practice. And it's also part of mine, obviously, as someone who advises on commercial disputes. It's just rare. It's not as common that we're actually there as these things are being implemented and you're right there on the front line. So on the front line in British Columbia, Laura, is it similar where if an employee was told at the beginning of COVID, we are sending you home because of this pandemic, we'll get you back in the office when we can, and then they buy a place in Skookumchuck and they just say, I'm moving there and I'm not coming back, that's a different situation from the employer's perspective than the employee who lived in Skookumchuck to begin with and they were hired on during the pandemic to work remotely? Is it similar in BC as in Ontario and in Quebec?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the general framework for constructive dismissal is going to be the same as what Justine and Emily have described. And so you'd be looking at what was communicated and what were the expectations and whether those expectations changed. I mean, arguably, if an employer sent an employee home at the beginning of the pandemic and, you know, said something about, okay, we'll try to return you in due course, but then they never really did. Like, some employers have attempted return to work a couple of times already, maybe had to backtrack a little bit based on the circumstances. But they've been communicating throughout, they've made it clear. That could be different than the situation of employer whose employee tells them, I'm moving to Skookumchuck, and the employer doesn't say anything.
Right.
And they say, you know, I just think it's going to be a better quality of life for me and my family. So, you know, trust that's okay. And the employer doesn't say anything about how that's okay for now. You know, these changes can be sort of implied in the employment relationship. And for an employer to then later backtrack if they haven't said anything for 2 years is a different situation than an employer who has been, you know, steadily communicating throughout. The one thing I did also want to add, just to circle back to the family status discussion, is that the law in British Columbia is somewhat different. We have a higher threshold for establishing family status discrimination in British Columbia. The test, I won't get into the details necessarily, but just be aware that there are jurisdictional differences in that front. And in BC, the test as to whether you are being discriminated against in the first place on the basis of your family status is a higher threshold to meet. And so our tribunals and then on review, the courts have been less receptive perhaps to claims about childcare obligations than they have, for example, based on what Justine's saying in Ontario.
Interesting. Okay. Well, that's why I'm glad that we have a national firm and we can have all the different regional and jurisdictional perspectives represented. Let me turn now to the last thing I wanted to cover with the three of you, and that's just the day-to-day management of a hybrid workforce, which is a new challenge for a lot of employers. What's different? And this is obviously a very long answer that could potentially be given to this question, but what's different in general terms, starting with you, Laura, about managing a workforce where you have some employees working remotely and some employees working from the workplace?
Versus everyone working in the office.
Yeah, I mean, like what do I as an employer need to do that I wouldn't otherwise have to do in order to ensure that I'm setting up that environment, that hybrid setup in a way that's sustainable and that's managing risk on my part?
Yeah, so a few things. I mean, I think one of them that is obviously front of mind for many employers is culture. Just making sure that employees have the connections that they need to get to know one another, to work together effectively, and things like that. Another one would be technology policies, employees, you know, use of devices, making sure that the employer is clear about, the expectation that of privacy that the employee does or does not have in the equipment that they use. Fairness would be another one to keep in mind. So ensuring that employees who work from home are treated, you know, generally speaking, the same as employees in the office, if that's the setup that the employers decided to go with, a hybrid environment where employees have some degree of choice, either make sure that they're treated consistently or make it clear that, employees who show up to the office, you know, are obviously going to get more face time, et cetera, and that may reflect in how they progress in their career.
Justine and Emily, jump in here. I know that it's going to be, as I say, it could be a very, very long list, and I'm not putting Laura on the spot.
I think it might be very niche, but I'm getting a lot more and more questions about jurisdiction. And I'm thinking here, for instance, it's an employer only having offices in BC and has an employee working remotely from Quebec.
Right.
Well, does the Quebec Labor Standards Act apply? Does it have to register with BCNE SST? What about tax-wise deductions? So these are all interesting questions that have been that we've been getting a lot lately.
And I assume these are fact-specific answers to these questions that you're giving. Like there's no
very just, much so.
Yeah. Good news for outside counsel maybe, but or for the lawyers in-house. But Justine, what about health and safety policy? Like if I am making my employees who are coming into the office, for example, watch the mandatory training videos about how to ensure that the workplace is safe and free of harassment and those sorts of things. Do I have to modify those if I'm an employer and a significant proportion or just any proportion of my workforce is working remotely?
I think the principles should always remain the same. I do know some clients that have maybe changed the examples that they would go through, because workplace harassment doesn't have to be an in-person interaction. It can be over email or Skype, Messenger, or on these Zoom calls. So I do know some employers are maybe changing the examples that they might share with employees and sort of considering, you know, maybe updating their policies to include examples that are a little bit more relevant to today. I think that's really what's key is when you've got a hybrid workforce, and you know, some people are working 100% remotely. When you go and review your employee handbook or you're reviewing policies, bear in mind that just things may apply a little differently. And so have you covered off everything? So you want to have one comprehensive policy, but have you taken into account all of those types of situations? From a health and safety perspective, one thing that's been quite interesting in Ontario, and it's come up a couple of times in my practice, are questions about domestic violence, because that's actually included in definitions under the Health and Safety Act, or it's encompassed by those definitions. And so I know some employers have put a little bit more emphasis in their training on the resources that are offered now that the majority of their workforces work from home. So whether it's their employee assistance program or just directing people to those resources where maybe that wasn't something that was such a focus before, or something thought about too much before, but that's another change I've seen.
Laura, what about mental health and psychological well-being? Because that's an issue that we know has come to the fore as people are working remotely and are dealing with some of the mental health challenges that come with being isolated as opposed to being in a workplace. Does that change how an employer should approach employee training, onboarding, education, and health and safety policies and so forth?
In broad strokes, I would say not. As Justine said, it's probably helpful to draw attention to various scenarios that may arise, to speak openly about the challenges that employees may be experiencing, to repeatedly point them towards resources that are available, to encourage them to raise those matters with their manager or human resources as appropriate. You know, if they are experiencing those challenges, you want to sort of make sure that the employee gets the help they need and that any mental health issues they're dealing with are, you know, addressed as promptly as possible and as effectively as possible for everyone's good. And that actually brings me to another thing I was going to raise just now was on the subject of mental health, being managing employees' time and ensuring that your policies and practices are sort of well thought out, I mean, would be the number one thing. Fine if you want to have a workplace with some flexibility in hours. Maybe that's a recruitment draw for you, that you don't require employees to work set hours of, you know, 8:30 to 4:30 or what have you. But make sure that whatever you do, you have oversight and that that the expectations are clear, whatever they are. E.g., it's fine if you want to work evenings, but make sure you don't work overtime, you know, unless it's authorized in advance. Or actually, no, we are a workplace that still, despite working from home, our hours are 9 to 5 and you're expected to be reasonably available, comparable to how you were in the office setting during that time. Try to help employees set the boundaries that they need and that, you know, ultimately should be good for productivity and mental health in terms of what's working time and what's home time, and build that into your policies as well.
Justine, let me just ask you on this very point.
Actually, if you don't mind, Adam, I just want to make a little plug. I think that segues really well into something that's really top of mind for a lot of Ontario employers, which is that recently the Ontario government, in the lead up to the election,
you've anticipated my question. This is what I was going to ask you about.
We were both going to talk about this. So the Ontario government has put in a requirement under RESA for employers to have a disconnection policy. So we're assisting a lot of organizations right now with preparing these policies and helping them go through the analyses of, you know, what does disconnection look like in our workforce? And a big part of what Laura was just describing is really key to this policy. What are our hours expectations? How are we tracking hours for people who are not eligible for overtime versus those who are eligible for overtime? Are we treating them differently? A lot of thought around that. I mean, in Ontario, I think the buzz in the media is that it's sort of this right to disconnect. It's not a right to disconnect. It's a right to know if you can disconnect. So your employees only have as much right to disconnect as you give them in this policy. However, you need to ensure that you're complying with hours of work requirements, overtime requirements, and everything else. So, yeah.
I don't think that fine print is going to make it into any election advertisements in this upcoming provincial election campaign. But let me ask you this though, Justine. If I've got a workforce where I'm allowing people to work flexible hours, as Laura was describing, and I have some proportion of my workforce that are working remotely and they're working late shifted hours, you know, they're not morning people, so they come online at 10 o'clock and they want to work until 7 or 8 in the evening. And those people are sending emails until they log off at 7 or 8 in the evening. Is there a risk that by allowing that kind of flexibility, I could run afoul of these new requirements in Ontario, because people who are supposed to be left alone after 6 o'clock in the evening are going to get emails from people who are still working until 7 or 8. Like, is this the kind of jigsaw puzzling that has to happen now?
So there's nothing in the legislation that says you have to, you know, again, you don't have to have your employees disconnect, right. But if you have, it's about setting those expectations, right? And how are you going to enforce them? So you can tell your employees, okay, you don't have to, like, you can log off at 5 p.m., whatever your working hours may be, you know, and you know, potentially not respond to that email that evening. Are you going to, if that's your policy, you need to stick with your policy, because the employee who gets upset about being told, oh, you should have logged back in and responded to that email, is going to say, well, you've just provided me this policy that says this. So that's also why we're working with organizations to come up with wording and policies that are actually going to be practical in the way that they can be applied to the workplace and implemented. You know, and what types of exceptions will play into it. Like, all of those things need to be considered when you do this. But your disconnection policy doesn't have to be complex. You just need to have one under the legislation. But you can imagine it's been a great jumping off point for a lot of employers to start thinking about these issues.
Sure.
Particularly in light of the hybrid working environment. It really is an opportunity to step back and say, what do we want our workplace and workforce to be like going forward? And, you know, we're preparing this policy. Let's codify it in a policy.
Well, I am very mindful of just how busy a time this continues to be for everyone who practices labor and employment law. And I am so grateful to the three of you for taking as much time as you have to help me unpack these issues for myself, as an addition to for our listeners. So let me give you the right to disconnect and wish you all the best. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you, Adam.
Justine Lindner is a partner, and Laura DeVries and Emily Thibault are associates in McCarthy Tatro's Labor and Employment Group in Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal, respectively. This episode of Law in the Time of COVID-19 was produced by Samantha Ma and Shane Lamond. If you've liked what you've heard, please subscribe and tell your friends to do the same. You can also find lots more content on our firm's website at www.mccarthy.ca. I'm Adam Goldenberg. Thanks for listening.